Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Episcopal bishops in the United States vote overwhelmingly to remain within the Anglican fold by agreeing to demands laid down by leaders of the worldwide communion. As Zimbabwe's economic crisis worsens, hundreds of thousands of desperate people are crossing the border to neighbouring South Africa. A moment of musical refreshment at one of Rome's busiest tourist sites, the Trevi Fountain. But first, Pope Benedict continues his teaching on the early Christian leaders at his weekly general audience. Welcome to the programme. Pope Benedict XVI on Wednesday spoke of the Christian virtues of a simple lifestyle and concern for the needs of the poor. His words came as he greeted thousands of pilgrims and visitors attending his weekly general audience in St. Peter's Square. My colleague Emma McCarthy takes a closer look.
In last week's general audience, Pope Benedict retraced the early life and works of the 4th century saint. This week, he focused on the years when St. John Chrysostom was the Bishop of Constantinople, the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire, when he proposed a Christian model for society based on the primacy of the person.
In 397, when he became Bishop of Constantinople, he set an example to the people of the city by his simplicity of life and his constant concern for the poor. He did not hesitate to speak out against corrupt or pagan practices, even in the imperial court, and for this he was sent into exile.
But apart from his outspoken defense of human dignity, Pope Benedict noted that the saint's lasting legacy lies in his theological teachings.
In his teaching, he showed how our wonder at the beauty of creation should lead us to give glory to the Creator. Yet God is also a tender Father, a healer of souls, and an affectionate friend. The Creator of the universe loved us so much that he did not spare his only Son. The Holy Spirit also features prominently in St. John's writings, the life force that transforms the world and gives wings to those Christians who are docile to the Spirit's promptings. This authoritative teaching earns St. John Chrysostom the title of a second St. Paul, Teacher of the Universe. The exiled bishop continued until his death to proclaim the infinite love of God who wants all to be saved.
With his last breath, concluded the Pope, St. John Chrysostom spoke of the ultimate end of human life, the glory of God.
Let us learn from St. John's example to love Christ and the poor and to bear faithful witness to the truth of the gospel.
And my thanks to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's weekly general audience. Anglican or Episcopal bishops in the United States have agreed overwhelmingly to meet the demands laid down by leaders of the worldwide Anglican Communion over issues of same-sex blessings and ordinations of openly gay bishops. A final statement from the House of Bishops meeting in New Orleans on Tuesday reaffirmed the desire to remain within the Anglican Communion by agreeing not to allow such ordinations or public blessing ceremonies, a move that would also serve to strengthen dialogue between Anglicans and the Catholic Church. Anglican theologian Father Bill Franklin is a former member of the Anglican Roman Catholic Dialogue in the United States. He takes a closer look at that statement from the House of Bishops and its implications for the wider Anglican Communion.
Yes, the bishops concluded their meeting and they issued a statement on September 25th that responded to the requests of the primates of the Anglican Communion in February. First, they agreed overwhelmingly, the bishops, to exercise restraint by not consenting to the consecration of any candidate to the episcopate whose manner of life presents a challenge and stands in the way of the communion. And secondly, they pledged not to authorize public rites for same-gender blessings until a broader consensus emerges in the Anglican Communion. And then, third, they agreed to allow Episcopal visitors to represent the presiding bishop in dioceses which are more conservative and would prefer having a more conservative bishop represent the presiding bishop. So in fact, three aspects of the request of the primates issued last February have been agreed to by the Episcopal Church. And I think that this is a very important development, which helps to keep the Anglican Communion together at a very important moment. These three agreements followed a visit of Archbishop Rowan Williams, the Archbishop of Canterbury, to the House of Bishops.
Do you think then that Archbishop Williams' presence there in New Orleans was crucial to the achievement of this agreement?
Yes, I think that the presence of the Archbishop of Canterbury did make a difference. A number of bishops said that they were really sobered by hearing from the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, and other primates who came with him. It's one thing, they said, to read reports about what the rest of the Anglican Communion feels about the actions of the Episcopal Church. But it's another thing to sit face-to-face with people expressing those concerns. The Episcopal bishops listened. They responded to the concerns in a way which I believe allows the Anglican Communion to remain together.
Were you surprised, though, by this agreement? Because, as you know, beforehand, many people were predicting the worst and talking of schisms and so on.
I think I had certainly picked up widespread support for remaining in the Anglican Communion. And I was worried whether this support would be divisive or it would be unanimous. But it appears there was an overwhelming desire by the bishops to remain a part of the communion by responding to these. There didn't seem to be a division over these issues, and I think that's very important. The bishops have spoken. Now we'll have to see how other members of the Episcopal Church respond.
And my thanks there to Father Bill Franklin, a former member of the Anglican Roman Catholic Dialogue in the United States. Make a joyful noise unto the Lord. That's exactly what a group of English musicians and singers have been doing in Rome this week, performing a series of reflections in words and music in the Church of Saints Anastasia and Vincent, opposite one of the Eternal City's busiest tourist sites, the Trevi Fountain. I was curious to find out more about this group, made up entirely of professional musicians, looking for a way to share the joys of their Christian faith with others through their music. And so I went along to discover what this ecumenical initiative was all about. 11 o'clock on a sunny September morning at the Trevi Fountain. As you'd expect, thousands of tourists taking photos and throwing coins into the water as street vendors offer flowers, souvenirs or children's toys. But suddenly the sound of a trumpet rings out across the crowds from the church on the corner of the piazza to announce the new English orchestra and choir with one of their recreatio, or short moments of musical refreshment. Pianist and composer Nigel Swinford is the founder and conductor of the New English Orchestra. As the choir warmed up in the vestry, he told me more about the origins of this rather special group.
Yes, it started in 1976, and it was always supposed to be an ecumenical thing for Christian musicians as an opportunity to express their faith, really. Obviously, their lives are given over to artistic expression, but they found it useful to have something with a specific Christian aim, so that even if you were playing a Beethoven symphony, to actually do it with other Christians as an act of worship, just as you might sing a hymn in another context. They found that liberating, and I think different things happen to the music. Interesting artistic things can happen to the music as well. That's what we found. It's an experimental thing, of course.
So you've got Christians of all different denominations here, haven't you?
That's right. I mean, there's a large pool of people. What you see here is a minuscule representation. I mean, there are just six players and 14 singers. There's a huge pool of probably running into the thousands of musicians, as you can imagine, after 32 years nearly. And they're all denominations, yes, absolutely.
And the music that you play is everything from Handel to gospel, spirituals?
Yes, that's also very ecumenical. I mean, you'll hear today, for instance, if you stayed on, you'd hear part of a Bach cantata, Praise God in All Lands, Jauch set Gott. But you'll also hear Oh Happy Day. Because, you know, especially these days, musicians like a variety of music. It's very old-fashioned, the idea that you only play classical music or that you only like that. I mean, especially young ones today, they like to go to clubs and they like to play jazz. And to express Christ in a number of different genres helps them, and we hope it's some kind of blessing to the people who come in here.
Why Rome? Why playing here at the Trevi Fountain, one of the most popular tourist sites in Rome?
Well, this is the wonderful thing, that people are here already. From our own point of view, we don't have to spend huge amounts of money publicising, because as you may be able to hear in the background, there's a trumpet playing. There are thousands of people already outside around the fountain. They've just got to take a few paces. They can come in here, a 35-minute event, quite free. And it has its own charm and it has its own blessing.
You don't actually call it a concert, do you? You call it a reflection in words and music.
Yes, that's right. Recreatio, we've coined the term. It is actually a service of worship. If you stay, you'll hear readings from the Bible. And it's not a concert. It's a meditation. Because we're Christians, that's what it is. It's a service of worship.
And after 32 years, you're still encouraging others. You opened a European branch as well, I understand, haven't you?
Yes, in fact, one of the violinists in the string quartet here today leads our sister organisation, the New European Orchestra, which conveniently has the same initials, of course. Yes, people from Switzerland, people from Germany in particular. Not anybody from Italy yet, sadly.
But you're working on it.
We're working on it.
Variety of music is interspersed with short readings from Reverend Roger Oldfield, who's been associated with the orchestra since its earliest days.
I used to be vicar of the church where I'm now associate minister, and 15, 20 years ago, Nigel Swinford, the conductor, came to the church and worshipped with us and became part of our congregation. And so right from those early days, we've been involved in supporting, praying, and mainly being at home. I've never travelled with them before, so this is the first time I've travelled with them. Over the years, we've just built friendship as well, but we've supported them as a church, and quite a few members of the church also sing with the New English Orchestra.
So why the trip here to Rome? What's so special about coming here?
I think for a long time we've prayed and thought about expanding from Salzburg, and Rome was one of those areas where they felt God was pulling them towards Rome. And so this is the first, as you know, of this kind of activity. But it's very difficult to define it, really. It was just a kind of draw, magnetism towards Rome.
Something of an ecumenical pilgrimage, perhaps part of a deeper dialogue between the different churches?
I think that's part of it, because the orchestra is a complete mixed group of people from various churches, and in fact the churchmanship disappears, and it is much more to do with our unity in Christ and our desire to share Christ with others. So I think that's part of it, and I think it's a very important part, because I think the unity is actually part of the power, part of the strength of the group and how they work together. But I think it's really to share Christ. It's to bring something of the fragrance of Christ, the reminder of Christ, into people's busy lives, and to surprise them, as you probably talk to people. I think a lot of people are sort of surprised. Suddenly God has come across their tracks and taken them by surprise, and it's a gift. So it's a gift from the Lord to them, and I think we see it as sharing Christ in a variety of ways with people at different levels.
I was sitting at Trevi, a fontaine. I'm Dutch, so I don't speak English very well. And then there was a trumpet suddenly, what was very inviting to me. So I entered the church, and it was marvellous.
They were extremely good technically, apart from anything. And there were quite a few, I mean, there was a folk song I'd never heard before, and I'd love to hear again. I've been asking about it. I would dearly love to hear it again. And in fact, although we're going home on Thursday, I wouldn't say no to coming back again in the hope of hearing it again.
I came to see the church because I love looking at churches, and they were just beginning, and I said, oh, I'll go out, and they said, no, come on in. And so I called Peter.
Yes, and I bet you did. It was beautiful.
What kind of impression did it make on you?
Very moving.
Do you think there should be more of this kind of initiative in the churches,
I've
perhaps?
I've been in a bit of a limbo, I suppose. My son died last year, and but this is...
Yeah. You found it touched you very personally?
Oh, gosh, yes.
I think, certainly back in England, when we do the bigger concerts, people find that it touches them in a way, I think, that they're lacking in other areas. It's a special sort of touch, I think, that the combination of music and word, spiritual and, I would hate to say secular, you couldn't call Bach secular. I suppose the language of music, isn't it, touching people's lives. You know, people say that God speaks through the Bible. Yeah, he speaks through creation, he speaks through Jesus, and speaks through music in a whole variety of ways.
Refreshing and uplifting music of the new English orchestra and singers led by their conductor Nigel Swinford. As Zimbabwe's economic crisis worsens, experts have warned the country is close to complete collapse, with the world's highest inflation rate and soaring unemployment. 4 out of 5 Zimbabweans now live below the poverty line, and it's estimated that up to a quarter of the country's population has fled. Many of these migrants have gone to neighbouring South Africa, and while there are few reliable figures on the numbers crossing the border, estimates consistently refer to 3 million Zimbabweans now living in South Africa. And that number appears to be swelling all the time, with as many as 3,000 people a day slipping across the border as their own country slides into ever deeper economic chaos. Many of these Zimbabweans, mostly young and destitute men, are reduced to sleeping out in the open in the border areas as they search for casual labour or ways of supporting themselves and their families back home. Father Michael Gallagher works for the Jesuit Refugee Service in South Africa and has just returned from a trip to the Zimbabwean border to see firsthand the desperate plight of these migrants. He spoke to my colleague Susie Hodges about what he saw.
The people that we spoke with during our survey, all of them had entered South Africa without going through formal processes, so illegally.
And how
risky and dangerous is that? I mean, you've got the Limpopo River, which I gather at times can be crocodile infested.
That's correct. At this time of year, it's not that bad, but when the rains start, the crocodiles will come up further again.
Isn't there any kind of border fence, and how do they get across that?
There is a rudimentary border fence by the main port of entry, which is Messina. It's rather extensive. It's three levels of fencing. But about 15 kilometers to the east of Messina, it just drops down to a single fence, which can be cut. And we saw places where people just could open a gate and walk through. So there were places where it was very easy to enter.
But if these people are either caught entering or else discovered and picked up by police afterwards, what happens to them?
Generally, they're very rather quickly deported back to Zimbabwe. The International Organization of Migration has a reception center just inside Zimbabwe. They show that they have received over 100,000 people who have been deported in the first 8 months of 2007.
And as far as you know, are there people there that are maybe so desperate to leave that they keep trying, even if they get deported, they will make another attempt to get to South Africa?
Oh, yes. We spoke with several people who had been back and forth a couple of times. The situation in Zimbabwe is dreadful and is indeed life-threatening. I just read a report earlier of a priest talking about going up and doing the last rites or encountering people who had died at the hospital the night before, one of whom had died because they'd been on a life support system and the electricity went out, so they died. Another was a diabetic, and he died because they didn't have any medicine, any insulin anymore. So, I mean, simple things that you would expect in a developed society are no longer available there, and people are fleeing to get away from that.
So yeah. A lot of these people that have fled, they're to all effects destitute. How are they coping? How would you describe the plight of these people living along the border? You said there weren't camps.
There are no camps. We met two groups, and each time the group had gathered around a tree and were sleeping under a tree and then looking for work in the neighboring villages or towns. So they were living outdoors with no facilities whatsoever. One group of folks had just arrived that day and they'd come a good 100 kilometers from the border when we met them, and they were quite tired and worn out. And while we were talking with them, some others who had been there for a bit longer came up and joined in the conversation.
These people, how are they coping when it comes to food and water? Do they have supplies of their own or what?
No, they have to just either make some money and buy some food, or sometimes they get assistance from charitable groups. But we didn't encounter a lot of groups up in the northern part of South Africa who were providing assistance to these people. It's a huge problem. It's a huge human situation.
How do the local population feel about this influx of Zimbabwean refugees?
We encountered two distinct reactions. One would be a reaction of fear, but at the same time, a great deal of sympathy for the people who have come. But there was a fear of theft because the people are so poor coming across. And it makes it easy to blame any theft that occurs on the foreigners. The second reaction was a much more hospitable, where we encountered some traditional leaders who were making space for these people, allowing them to stay in the grounds and even build shacks and things like that.
Is it mostly men who fled?
That seems to be what we saw. During our time there, we only encountered two women, mostly men, young men between 18 and 35 or 40.
And how would you describe their morale?
They were disappointed that they haven't found anything that can help them, help their families back in Zimbabwe. I think they felt a bit abused by the people who did hire them, because they were hiring them for just a real pittance. One group of people we met who were working on a farm reported that they were getting 14 rands a day, which would be about the equivalent of $2 for a full day's work.
How do those salaries, should we say, those wages compare to what a South African will be paid?
I believe that the South African labor law would require that the farm laborers should be getting somewhere about 100 rand a day, or 800 a week, as opposed to 100 a week. Yeah, they're getting ripped off.
Did any of those people consider going back, or do they say that the situation in Zimbabwe is just so awful that they simply don't want to go back?
Right now, it doesn't make any sense to go back. There's no work at all in Zimbabwe. And if you do have work there, your wages are frozen at present. And they're still using this myth of the one U.S. dollar to 250 Zim dollars, whereas in the informal market, it's over, you know, 40, 50,000 to a U.S. dollar now. So there's no food on the shelves. The money you get, you can't buy anything with. So why stay? It's better to take a chance in South Africa. At least you get some real currency when you do find the work.
How do they feel about the situation in their home country? Are they angry? Are they sad? How do they feel about the way that Zimbabwe's economic and political situation has gone so badly wrong?
Well, I've been in Zimbabwe a couple of times this year. The feeling of the people who I meet on this side in South Africa is similar to the ones that I meet in Zimbabwe, and that's generally a sense of abiding sadness about how this really wonderful country has gone so quickly down the tubes. I mean, there's all sorts of very good things that could happen and have happened before in Zimbabwe, which have just stopped, and everybody feels very sad about that, and I did not encounter anger. They're not political refugees, but they're refugees under the African Convention, because it says that if there's events seriously disturbing public order in all or part of the country and people leave because of that, they're entitled to refugee status. So the people, in our view, are refugees, the ones who come over here, because the economic collapse of that country are events that seriously disturb public order.
Apart from the border area that you saw, is it now common in South Africa to see Zimbabwean refugees in the country's main cities?
Yeah, I think that from all the reports that I've heard, there are a large population of Zimbabweans who have entered South Africa. About 19,000 Zimbabweans applied for asylum in South Africa, which is the largest single nationality group which applied in 2006. And the numbers are still big and growing.
Does everybody then believe that this exodus from Zimbabwe is not only set to continue but is likely to increase?
Yeah, I think if the situation continues to deteriorate there, more people are going to, you know, vote with their feet and leave the country.
Are you trying to lobby the government, or rather the police, not to deport these people?
Yes. JRS has gone on record to say that South Africa should recognize everybody who comes in from Zimbabwe right now as a refugee and treat them in accordance with the international and its own legislation, chief among which would be not to send them back to where they came from.
And my thanks there to Father Michael Gallagher of the Jesuit Refugee Service, talking to Susie Hodges. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Be sure to join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can. Don't forget, also, you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Simply look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.